Today's episode of Trust Me is brought to you by the Amazon Music exclusive podcast, Suspect, Vanished in the Snow. Download the Amazon Music app today.
If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group,
or if you've had experience with manipulation or abuse of power that you'd like to share,
leave us a message on our hotline number at 347-86-TRUST.
That's 347-868-7878.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't.
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and manipulation from two Benjamins who've actually experienced it. I am Lola Blanc.
And I'm Megan Elizabeth.
And we're Benjamins, you guys, because it's our 100th episode.
I cannot believe this.
You guys, how did we do it?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I remember when we first started, we were like, how are we going to find enough guests?
And to fill five episodes.
Yeah.
We were like, are there five people we could talk to? 100?
But there's so many more. I mean, I feel like we've uncovered all of this. Not uncovered. I feel like we have
cracked the case.
We have discovered there are so many more groups than we ever could have imagined.
Oh, yeah, we've hardly scratched the surface.
And there are so many facets of extreme belief to explore still. There's so much I want to get into with y'all. But for now, let's go over some highlights.
Yeah. Let's overview.
If anyone hasn't listened to every single episode of the show, and if you have, holy shit, thank you. But I'm assuming most people have not. So we're going to go over just some like 101 cult stuff, some of our favorite stories, favorite moments that kind of exemplify the cult experience and the cult recovery experience. So let's begin at the beginning with the ultimate, the cult expert himself and friend of the show, dare I say, Steve Hazen, who's going to tell us about what cults are. Steve was in the Moonies himself, so he knows all of this stuff from firsthand experience, but he's also written multiple books about cults, including Combating Cult Mind Control, which is kind of a seminal book on undue influence and high control groups and all that stuff. So let's hear from Steve. Tell us, what defines a cult? This is something people ask me all the time, and I have a general idea of it, but I want to hear from the expert himself.
So there are lots of different people with lots of different ways of explaining it, and I'll tell you my way of explaining it. But first, I'll say there are theological definitions, but that's not what I use at all. I use psychology.
Good.
Social psychology, and the baseline model is Chinese communist brainwashing. So I have this influence continuum. Imagine an arrow going in two directions. One direction is ethical influence, and one is unethical influence. So I say there's a lot of influence everywhere. We're constantly being influenced by each other, etc., by the media, by our families. But there's a real distinction of ethical influence. You have informed consent. You know what you're getting into. You're free to leave. You can read whatever you want to read. You can talk to whoever you want to talk to. It's love-based. It's conscience-based. It's respecting your creativity and your free will. So you can be in a cult of like loving a particular band or sports team or whatever and be like really fanatically into it. But there's like no penalty if you leave it.
Right.
You don't feel guilty if you miss a game because you're sick or you want to be at your kid's soccer game or something like that. But what the bulk of my work and how I make a living is helping people who've been victimized by unethical influence. So there's lying by withholding vital information, distorting information, or outright lying to you. Fear, information control. And that's where we get into my BITE model, right? B stands for behavior control. I stands for information control. T stands for thought control. And E stands for emotional control. So for example, under emotional control, they make you feel special on the one hand, like you're chosen. But mostly it's about guilt and fear. And the universal is what I call phobia indoctrination, which is the implantation of irrational fears that if you ever leave the group or even question the leader, terrible things are going to happen to you. You're going to go insane. You're going to be possessed by demons. You're going to be hit by a car. I have in my book, Freedom of Mind, in chapter 10, I have 4 pages, single space, of the most common phobias that I've worked with
over
40 years. But if you look at them, you know, for ex-members, it's like a revelation. Oh, my God, we did this one. We did this one.
Right,
we did this one.
Right.
We did this one.
Wow.
But, you know, because it's psychological slavery is what authoritarian cult mind control does. You don't have physical bars in many cases, just psychological and emotional bars. So you can leave the cult anytime you want, right? The door's there. But the minute you get up and you start walking, then you get surrounded by members and they start doing, but Satan is coming or whatever the cult
is. Yeah, just even your own thoughts. Like,
right.
Wow, I have not listened to this in so long. And that is such an interesting thing to hear again. Phobia indoctrination is such a big component.
Car wrecks were a big one in mine.
Which one?
Car wrecks.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was always these people, this person, they left the way and they were in a horrible car accident, and they are very dead and in hell.
Yeah. I mean, in like Mormon offshoot religions, it's often, if you leave, you won't get to be with your family in eternity. You'll be separated from your loved ones for the rest of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're free to go if you want to be alone forever and not get to go to the top tier of heaven and not be with anyone you love and just be sad and lonely.
Your choice.
Yeah, and I love Steve's bite model. I mean, like he said, there are lots of different frameworks for thinking about cults, and my mom and I are actually working on something along those lines ourselves. But all of these different methods of control are what distinguish like a religion that can be like a little much sometimes from like an actual cult. And I liked his point about fandom as well, because like, of course, you can be a fan of a band and there be no consequences if you like don't go and bully the person online who said the thing you didn't like.
Right.
But if you're a member of a fandom and you will face social consequences if you don't do what they expect you to do, that's when it gets culty.
A very big warning sign for me is groups that talk more about how bad it is to not be a part of them than the good parts of being a part
of them. Totally.
I have the like craziest ear for that. Just a little note there.
Yeah, and anything – that's a really good point. I feel like when fear is the primary driving force that's keeping you a part of something, that's probably not a healthy sign.
Right.
Whether it's fear of leaving or just fear of everyone on the outside, fear of these mysterious forces.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, in the political sphere, that can definitely be one of the big red flags. Is like, are you just constantly in fear? Maybe this isn't the right space for you.
Right. Although the world is pretty terrifying right now.
True. But if the people, but if it's not solution, like concrete solutions
based, yes,
being offered to you, and it's just like, they'll ruin everything. It's all right, guys, but what are we going to do about it?
Agreed.
You know, and ideally that does not include breaking into anyone's home or killing anyone or taking over the, you know, whatever. Y'all know what I mean.
For sure.
So continuing on with people who have expertise on cults and get more of a broad picture of cults, we're going to listen to a clip from Rachel Bernstein. She is a licensed therapist who specializes in recovery from cults and extreme belief and such. And she also hosts another cult podcast called Indoctrination. So let's hear from Rachel Bernstein. I often give the example of Jim Jones, you know, having a person basically be in a wheelchair and then act as though they were healed and suddenly start walking again. These sort of like feigned miracles or like generated spiritual experiences, does that fall under that category as well? I'm really interested in this thing that happens where we're like, no, I truly had a spiritual experience. I witnessed the miracle, you know, but it's kind of all just forgery.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a both and kind of situation. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are people who will say, I really did have a mystical experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some groups, even one-on-one kinds of cults, but it happens more often in larger groups where there's the kind of social contagion that happens around you. So you notice other people speaking in tongues. So you start speaking in tongues because mm-hmm. you think that's what you're supposed to be doing, but you're kind of making it up as you go along, mm-hmm. but you're afraid how people are going to see you or what they're going to call you if you're not doing it too. But groups are very good at creating fervor, mm-hmm. at creating an intensity. And so people will abandon a lot of critical thinking if they are connected to that fervor, because it's like a drug, mm-hmm. and they love that. And a lot of people will do things that might feel superhuman during that time. I mean, I think about, as a total aside, it was when I was young, I remember we had a beloved dog who ended up being fine. This has a happy ending, but there was a person who backed up and had his tire on his car over my dog, like on his body.
Oh, no.
And my dad, I remember, my dad went over and lifted the back of the car.
Wow.
And I thought, well, okay. So I'm sure that if someone said, can you go lift that car? He'd be, no. But because there was this moment of panic of, oh, I have to do something, you can develop sort of parts of you that feel superhuman. And a lot of people will say, I had this transcendent moment, or I saw things, or I was able to do things that I couldn't do before. And that feeling can be cultivated through that adrenaline. Mm. And so that adrenaline certainly is kicked up a notch, a lot of notches. But yes, there are also people who are faking it, who are not in a wheelchair, but will enter the room in a wheelchair. There are people also who it was very interesting. It was like a sting operation for a televangelist years ago.
What? That's fun.
Yeah, I know. It was very interesting where he did all these healings. So people were suddenly able to walk again. It was like lords, you know, like holy water. And the reason there was a sting operation was for good reason, because he was encouraging people to go off their medication.
Oh, no.
Which was horrible. And then, as it is in cults, if you don't get cured, that's on you. Because you weren't praying hard enough or feeling it in your bones or whatever. So it's always on you. But he had all these people posted in different parts of the stadium where he had these services. And he was talking to them. And he had people planted in the audience to not be standing up, because they said they were not able to stand and be there on crutches. Mm. And suddenly they were able to stand. And so the sting operation was that they had a listening device where they could actually hear him then speaking to the different people in the crowd, saying, you're up, or you're on. Mm. And the camera would go right to them. So this was to cultivate that magical, that mystical manipulation. And it was totally fake.
Cultivate. All right. Get it, guys?
I'm still laughing at your joke. So stupid. I love this clip. One of the things I find the absolute most interesting about cults is the mystical manipulation, is this creating of an intense emotional experience, of a peak experience or whatever, and how you do that as a cult leader and how real it feels as someone who's a member. And it makes me think of this TikTok that someone sent me on Twitter. And here's what it says. I believe I sent it to you, Megan. I think it's very funny and it perfectly captures this sort of thing. It says, I believed in God as a kid because I always felt so moved during worship songs at my megachurch. And then I went to a One Direction concert and felt the same thing and realized I just like live music.
Yep.
It's so good to me, because it is like there are so many parts of life in which we can feel these like heightened emotions that are legitimate and real and feel like something really special and magical and spiritual is happening. But it's not because the person in the pulpit is magical.
Right.
It's because we are a part of something, or we are all meditating together, or we're all sleep deprived together, so we're hallucinating, like we're all participating in a really connected group environment, and that can make us feel very spiritual. We're all taking shrooms, you know.
Listen, singing together.
Singing together. Dude, some of my favorite memories in my entire life are just my friends and I breaking out into song together.
It's a beautiful thing, and church knows that, and it brings people together singing. It's a very moving experience. Mm-hmm. Even as a child, when I'd sing in like a choir at school, I would just cry the whole time because it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
People singing together. And it also makes me think of that guy we interviewed, Will, who talks about how his prophet would shine lights in people's eyes when their mm-hmm. eyes were closed to make them believe they were seeing the light, but then also manipulating the people who saw him do it by being like, I need them to believe so that they actually see the light. You know what? It just mm-hmm. never ends. And yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think we should always go toward those heightened experiences, and that is what life is about. But we should not trust when a group or a person is telling us that we can only get them from them.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It is very common for people to genuinely, like, see a light around the person or, like, hear, you know, like that does happen, and it still doesn't mean it's magic.
Well, also, who was the man that we interviewed who pretended he was a prophet and did that documentary where he told people...
Vikram Gandhi?
Yeah, where he was like, I'm a prophet, and then he had a big following, and then when he told them, I'm not actually a prophet, they were like, you just don't know you're a prophet, because...
Well, they were like, this is the greatest lesson of all!
Yeah, yeah. But like, just telling your mind in a kind of narrative therapy way, this is a prophet, mm-hmm. makes that person... a prophet.
Yeah. I mean, it's confirmation bias.
Exactly.
Like once, which comes back to the language thing, too. I mean, everything is about priming and the lens through which we are viewing the experiences mm-hmm. that we're having. Yeah. If we've been told by 25 people before we finally meet the leader that he's the most amazing person and he's given them all enlightenment and you can see him glowing, and like, we are primed to look for those things.
Right. If the sun is hitting you in a pretty way, I just think, mm-hmm. oh, the sun is hitting you. But if you're a prophet, I'm thinking, oh, my God, God is shining on you.
Totally.
You know? Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are so many examples of it, even with my mom and I, you know, dreams were things that I now I interpret dreams as like, oh, that's funny. I was thinking about X, Y, and Z. So I guess I had a randomized processing of those things. But when I was a kid, or like within the religion that we were in, Mormonism, we would have those dreams and be like, it's a sign.
Yeah.
It must mean this. And we'd be ascribing all this meaning to it. And that is a very classic cult tactic.
But don't you,
manipulating that.
Don't you think that dreams can bring messages like from your psyche? Not signs, just a message.
I think if you are very anxious and you have a very stressful dream,
right,
that can be like an indicator that you are anxious.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But I also, like, I've had dreams that I'm cheating on my partner. I literally could want nothing less than that. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I've had dreams that my best friend betrayed me, and I'm like, I like my best friend.
Good. I'm glad you like her.
And so much of it, if I like actually go back and I'm like, oh, that element was probably from that movie because that's similar to that thing I watched mm-hmm. the other night. Like, but then again, you know, maybe I just have a really uncreative dream brain.
I've just worked with psychologists before who have looked at a dream and been like, oh, I think that this might be happening. And it's very abstract. It's not something I would come to on my own. It's
Jungian.
It's not like as simple as like, oh, your best friend's a bad person, you know. And I've gotten meaning from them before.
Yeah.
But as far as saying a sign is coming, I remember your mother dreamed of the prophet before she met mm-hmm, him because mm-hmm. she actually saw him before. And so that's when it gets dangerous.
Yeah. Well, to me, dream interpretation is similar to tarot cards, you know,
right.
Me as a skeptic, in that like it, whatever you already kind of know deep down, it's going to be a lens to help you sort of sort that out and organize it in your head.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. But
totally agree.
Doesn't mean that it's magical.
Right.
On a winter night in a small community near Denver, Colorado, Jim Matthews arrived home late. He expected to find his 12-year-old daughter who'd been dropped off after a Christmas concert. But when he called out, "Hi, Janelle," the house was eerily quiet. His daughter's shoes were on the floor, but she was gone, and it would be 35 years before she would be found. Dead. After the discovery of Janelle Matthews' body in 2019, the police turned their attention to a man who told law enforcement years ago that he knew something, but they dismissed him. The man did seem obsessed with the case, but is that all he was? A true crime fanatic? Or a killer? Now, a jury will decide if Janelle's murderer was hiding in plain sight the entire time. Wondery and Campside Media's podcast, Suspect, is back for a second season with a story that attempts to separate one man's true crime obsession from a motive for murder. Hey, Prime members, listen to the Amazon Music exclusive podcast, Suspect, Vanished in the Snow, in the Amazon Music app. Download the app today.
All right. So now we've been talking about manipulation. So let's talk about the ultimate manipulator. Let's get into what a charismatic leader can look like, a classic component of a cult. And we're going to do that with the ultimate cult leader, Charles Manson. So let's talk to Diane Lake, who wrote a book about her experiences as one of the Manson girls.
So I went with this other couple, and but I didn't enjoy being with them. They shot speed, and I wasn't interested in doing anything besides smoking some marijuana and taking LSD.
Right.
And so they invited me to come along with them to this, to, hey, meet this groovy guy and his girls, is basically was the invitation. And so I went with them, and I walked in. And it was this house that I'd already lived in with other people. So I knew the house, but I'd never heard of Charlie and the girls.
And this is in Topanga, right?
Yeah, at the base of the canyon, just in this little, you know, it's now like a park.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a preserve or a reserve type park. Anyway, I walked in, and I think it was Lynette that came up and went, oh, Diane! You know, Charlie, Diane's here. I was like, what?
You're like, who are you?
Right? How do you know me? It was magical and flabbergasting all at the same time. And Charlie got up from the circle and came and offered me a drink of his root beer and embraced me and, you know, welcome. Hey, come and join us in the circle, which was, you know, what we did most of the time, especially in the evening. We'd gather in a circle. And Charlie would play his guitar and sing his songs, and we would sing along.
Wow. So, and Lynette is squeaky, correct?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. This redhead girl comes up and is like so excited to meet you, and you don't know who she is, but you're suddenly welcomed by this whole group of strangers.
Right.
What was your first impression of Charlie? Like, what did he seem like? What was the vibe?
Fun. Totally. You know, playful. He wasn't an imposing figure at all. He's a short little guy,
mm-hmm.
you know, or was a short little man. And, you know, with curly hair. And really, I think we've analyzed this. I think he was like 33. Well, my youngest son is 31.
Mm.
And I certainly don't think of him as a lecherous old man, you know, and my oldest son is 37. But even when he was 33, I mean, it was like, oh. You know, handsome.
I love this episode so much. Diane Lake is amazing, as was her co-guest, Debbie Herman, who is her publisher of her book. To me, this just speaks to the sort of classic element of cults, although not every single cult, but almost every cult, which is the charismatic leader, which is the person who makes you feel so special and so loved and so important, and like they've been waiting for you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they have this like thing about them that just like makes you want to listen to them. I always wish I had a way of sort of quantifying or like organizing exactly what that is, because you just hear like, oh, they're charismatic. Like, I'm like, what does that mean? What does that mean? How do we know when someone is charismatic and it's bad,
right.
you know?
Yeah. I think if somebody is trying to draw you into a cause and they also seem very personally obsessed with you way too quickly,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little bit of a warning sign, even though it is an ego boost. But we just did an episode with Camille and Trillium, and they were talking about how when Kathy met one of them, she was like, oh, you're the a Scorpio or Pisces person that we've been waiting for to mm-hmm. fulfill the prophecy of whatever, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, oh, that's tempting, because who doesn't want to be that when you're a freshman in college?
Oh, it's like you're freaking Harry Potter.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the chosen one. Mm-hmm. They've been waiting for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very classic thing to do, to like sort of retroactively make up a prophecy and say that, ah, aha, it has been fulfilled. You are the one.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, I don't, probably not.
Right. And sometimes it's more vague than that, you know, just like, wow, you're so interesting. You're so
yeah.
whatever. But is there some sort of cause that they would like you to join? And is there some sort of immediate bond that seems mm-hmm. too quick, too fast, good to be true?
I mean, it's love bombing. I mean, it is love bombing.
Yeah.
That is, to me, a red flag. If somebody meets me and they immediately, like, want to be with me or want to be my best friend or like just are upset. I'm like, you don't know me.
Right. It, because if you did, you would not
You would
that.
Not like me. You'd be like, fuck this girl.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
No, but I mean, yeah, I think so. So, right. So there's the like charisma, like where they seem like they're just magnetic. And then there is also this like, and part of that is this love bombing, like making you feel really special. I think the charisma also, there's just like a confidence to speak in front of a lot of people and to have opinions that sound really wise and interesting.
And just to believe that they have the answers.
To believe, exactly. It is alluring when someone sounds like they know what they're talking about.
One of the things I've taken...
Don't you guys feel lured by me right now? Because it sounds like I know what I'm talking about.
But I mean, one of the things I've taken away from this the most is like, nobody really knows more than anyone else.
Yeah.
So come to your own answers authentically, and you don't have to like make anyone else believe them, but don't believe that somebody else's answer is magical.
Yeah.
Because I feel like especially women, that's how we lose a lot of our power, by being like, oh, thank God, an answer.
True. Although I would like to add that the scientific method...
Always helpful.
...is a very... useful method. So if there's been repeated science on something, then maybe you could trust the people who did the repeated, you know, peer-reviewed studies. But generally speaking,
yeah, those people usually aren't trying to get you in a cult, you know. usually Yeah. I mean, you know, there were people who, even after he murdered all of these people, still were like, yeah, go you.
Well, yes.
But
so the context that we kind of talk about in the episode, and y'all can go back and listen to it if you're interested, is that there were lots of sort of revolutionary groups and counter-revolutionary groups that were going on in like late 60s, early 70s. So there was a lot of domestic terrorism, bombings, whatever, people trying to sort of stick it to the man and tell the establishment to fuck off, basically. A lot of protesting. Anyway, so for particular groups who were engaging in that kind of
rhetoric, you
know, violence, rhetoric, whatever, initially they, what they talk about in the episode is that initially some of those groups saw the Manson murders, which I should say he didn't murder them,
yes,
but
of course
he
not.
Like had them done, saw them as
narcissists,
like, as like a, you know, like a revolutionary sort of thing to do, because it was rich people and it was the establishment and whatever. And he was trying to get the fucking race war started. But to me, that speaks to the culture at the time more so than, because people who didn't know him probably, I think, mostly were just afraid that someone was going to come kill them.
Yeah, I think people who didn't get the one-on-one time with him weren't very swayed, because he seemed pretty crazy.
Yeah, my understanding is that there was like sort of a nationwide panic after the Manson murders, and for the most part, people weren't like, this guy's cool.
Right. But some people were. And that speaks to cults.
It's true.
Speaking of.
So, yeah. So, speaking of cultural moments, cultural culty moments, y'all, we're going to talk about QAnon.
Whoop, whoop.
Jitarth Jadeja. He was our guest who was a former QAnon believer and kind of snapped out of it. He's so fucking funny and smart, and I'm so glad he graced us with his presence. Jitarth is going to tell us a little story here about the experience of being in QAnon and this like very tumultuous cultural moment and what that belief system was like for him. I'm curious about, as far as the like whole demon sort of superstitious side of that all, did you subscribe to that part? Because from my understanding of QAnon, there are a lot of sort of disparate connected beliefs, and not everyone has the same like sort of set of beliefs.
100%. So mine was even crazier, all right? There is no like Bible of QAnon, right? There's no like canon of QAnon. Everything in QAnon is just canon, because every conspiracy you've ever heard, and like I said, some that you haven't, can be projected onto QAnon, because Q doesn't post like specific things, or he didn't used to, right? Now he's very specific, like, oh, the Democrats are evil, blah, 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 right? Before it was a little bit more vague and open-ended, right? So there is a definite religious aspect to it. It used to be a little bit more like secular and apolitical. Like he was like Republicans and Democrats, and he didn't really use religious and spiritual jargon. But now he's like, he started quoting the Bible, mentions God a lot. So there's definitely a large swathe or swath of QAnon followers are like, you know, Southern conservatives and Catholics and Christians, because Q appeals to them because he uses Bible verses. I wouldn't say I'm religious. I may be spiritual a little bit, agnostic, but not in an atheist way. And I look, dude, I don't know. I feel like there could be something else, you know, than the three dimensions that we see. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that entails, but it feels like it could be true, right? At the time, though, I didn't believe in the whole demons thing. But what I did believe, this is what I did believe, that I had this conspiracy theory. This is how far I was into conspiracy theories before I found Q, right? I genuinely believed that there was a race of interdimensional alien birds who were bipedal, who were trying to save us from these, the lack of a better word, reptilians, right? And I believe that Q was working with military intelligence, because that's what everyone seems to believe, that Q's military intelligence, but that the military intelligence were working with these blue avians, they were called. Like, you can look them up. They're still around. Like, Corey Good, he's the guy who propagates it. But, like, yeah, like, the blue avians are behind QAnon, and, like, there was, like, this UFO disclosure, all right, like, the Pentagon UFO staff, and, you know, here and there. So, and Space Force had been announced, right? So I was like, yeah, dude, for sure, this is like UFO disclosure. It's the blue avians, like, and they're going to save us from the reptilians who are the ones behind the cabal.
Wow. Right? So you're much more in the sort of sci-fi version of the
cabal. Exactly.
Wow, that's fascinating. So the birds are what? They are what are
the fifth dimensional, all right, higher aliens who have come to our dimension to stop these other fifth dimensional aliens from stealing our souls, are our spirit, our energy, which crosses dimensions.
Wow.
Got it. Damn, I wish they were something a little bit sexier than birds, but okay.
Oh, classic Yikes. Joke.
Man.
Yeah, so to me, I mean, this just speaks to the thing that we always come back to here, which is that the beliefs aren't the point.
No, because that's a very smart person talking, saying very silly things to the non-indoctrinated mind.
Yes, this very silly. But I mean, like, when we break down many religious beliefs, like many of them are very silly. And the whole thing, the whole thing with cults is that the cult leaders frequently change the story all the time. They change the beliefs completely. The attachment that we experience as cult members is not to a particular idea. It's to a community or a person, or like feeling like we're a bigger part of something. And that QAnon is like really exemplifies that idea, because as he was saying, like, everyone's things that they believe are like vastly different in QAnon. Right.
Yes.
Like, for some people, it's about vaccines. For some people, it's about pedophiles. For some people, it's about stop the steal. For some people, it's about bipedal, blue, fifth dimensional birds. And for some people, or for many people, it's just extremely anti-Semitic. And, you know.
Well, and people took this really seriously. Yeah. Do you remember the man in Santa Barbara, Matthew Taylor Coleman, who killed his two children?
Yes.
With a, like, he was a very good father who was obsessed with his children. He took them to Mexico and killed them with a spear because he thought that they had demon DNA. I think this was 2019, 2020.
Yeah.
And wow.
I mean, there are so many examples of it now. It's like gotten really blurry because some of the QAnon sort of conspiracy theories have trickled down into mainstream politics now, as evidenced by a number of things that have happened in the past year or two. You know, it is extremely dangerous. I understand why conspiracy theories happen, because throughout history, let's just say American history, the government really has covered some shit up.
Lied to us, man.
The media really does have extreme bias in many ways. Mm-hmm. Like, so the instinct to not trust mainstream sources, like, I understand that.
Same.
But you can get so far down that rabbit hole.
I know.
Yeah. And it's hard to know. It can be really hard to parse where the difference is. And so I think it's really just about like making sure that when you are, quote, doing your own research, that doesn't mean just like listening to the one guy on YouTube or like that one Reddit thread or 4chan or 8chan or whatever the fuck.
That's a really good point. Yeah, finding multiple sources of different opinions. And
not dismissing science out of hand or not dismissing media outlets just because someone else told you to, you know, like.
And realizing if you're in a very fearful, vulnerable, whatever place in your life while you're watching this stuff and taking into consideration, is this permeating a little bit like more deeply because I'm not rock solid?
Totally. Totally. Also, y'all, media literacy.
Yeah.
Media literacy, because a lot of these conspiracy theories start with just some dude with a website who literally has no, there's just literally no evidence whatsoever for what he's saying. And people know they can make money off of that. And I think it's just like an absolutely evil thing to do. But there are so many people who run these like fake ass news websites and know that they're going to make a shit ton of money by stoking fear in the population.
Totally. Alex Jones, anyone?
All right, guys. So speaking of manipulation, let's move on to a very lovely guest we've had who was in a group that my mother and I have our own connections to, as you can hear in episode one, India Oxenberg. India Oxenberg is going to tell us a little bit about some of the practices within Nexium run by Keith Raniere. Can you walk us through EMs? What was an EM? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. You know, nobody's asked me that question. So cool. So an EM was called, it's called an exploration of meaning. And what it was within Nexium was kind of like a therapeutic process that also involved some hypnosis. But I'm giving you like what I know it is now. But what it was then was a tool that they used to disconnect any uncomfortable or inappropriate reactions that you were having to things that you thought were getting in your way. So the EM was like Nexium's crown jewel inside of the community. And they would use that tool in the intensives. And then once you were through the first 5-day intensive, you could purchase EMs from people who were called EMPs, which was like a practitioner without a, you know, without a license, obviously, because nobody was licensed, as we know. And it was a, they cobbled together some things from Scientology, some things from NLP, some things from hypnosis, and actually therapy too. And Nancy kind of promoted herself as a therapist when she actually is not. And it's a very, interesting thing to try to understand now from the outside, because I see it as very invasive and really unethical, because what they were doing was kind of putting you back into your trauma and then changing your feeling about it, but it actually disconnects your feeling to the reaction. So you go numb instead of thinking that you're healing.
Right.
So the more and more I did these EMs, I actually thought that I was getting better because I wasn't having reactions to things anymore. But what was really going on was I was disconnecting and disassociating from my own emotions and instincts. So I just like cannot stress how important it is to have licensed practitioners. Like, do not let anybody tamper with your brain.
Amen. This is such a common thing that cultish groups will do, which is make you talk about your trauma and air all your shit out in front of someone who isn't supposed to be doing that with you.
Scientology, anyone?
Yeah. And tell you that what they're doing is healing you, when in reality what they're doing is kind of just manipulating you.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, like, you know, with EMDR or with exposure therapy or all these different modalities of actual healing, like, what you are doing is you're taking out those memories and you're kind of reframing them and all, over time desensitizing yourself to them in a way that's constructive. But there's a way to do that that is not healing and that is not constructive. And it kind of overwhelms me to think about, to be honest, because our brains are just so malleable.
Yeah.
There are so many ways that you can like fuck with people if you don't understand exactly what you're doing and if you're not coming from a place of responsibility and care.
Exactly. And Nancy was not, in my personal opinion.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a bummer. Like Keith, you know, Keith and L. Ron Hubbard and so many of these people, they're like pulling from sources that like are
biased,
legitimate. Well, no, they'll take from different sources that have legitimacy to them.
Right.
So they feel like they're getting at something real and they're inventing this new thing, but really they're just kind of stealing from other people and then doing it in an unethical way and like changing it so it's not actually healthy.
Right. Like they bias it to their own beliefs and then change it into something absolutely lunatic-y, but has like new name, new word, but it has some like basis and science and reality and whatever. And then you get confused.
Right. We instinctively feel like dealing with our trauma is, you know, that's a good thing. And if someone tells us this is how to do it and we don't really necessarily know better and that person seems like an authority and is, you know, marketing themselves as an authority, then we're going to trust that person.
Of course.
And make ourselves vulnerable before them, which then can allow them to kind of move in on that vulnerability and make you do whatever they want.
Yeah. If something has a really weird name, EMDR excluded, I'm wary of it sometimes.
I mean, it is funny because many therapies, I feel like, modes of
yeah
they do have very weird
some
names.
Of them do, but there's, if it's a religion, how about that?
Totally And even some therapeutic practices, I'm sure, are just by some random woman who's like, I've invented the
our man
healing chromatics or something.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds good. I'd sign up.
What does chromatic mean? I don't remember.
Color,
you know, just one way. You know, whether it's in a group or one-on-one with somebody who's sort of high up in the group, these are just different ways that cults will manipulate. Yeah. Speaking of manipulation, Frank Lyford was a member of Heaven's Gate. He is featured in the HBO docuseries on Heaven's Gate. And one of the things that he's going to talk to us about in this clip is how not only were all of his external circumstances controlled by the group, but even his own thoughts. Tell us about when the class begins. What happens? You all kind of settle in one area, right?
Right. And it was Wyoming where we were all called to gather. There could have been as many as 200 people there. And that was wild. That was like, I think of the children of Israel, you know, wandering in the wilderness. The people who were unruly, and the people were unruly there. It's crazy. So that was what T&O wanted to do, was kind of bring us together into the same mindset and to help us establish some kind of discipline. First, there was a lesson about kindness and consideration, things that made sense. So that was kind of a first basic essential lesson. And a few weeks or months later, we had something called the 17 steps, which were guidelines for how to live in ways that were becoming to members of the next level, so that we would fit in there, so that we wouldn't stick out like a sore thumb, so that we wouldn't be disruptive.
Once you get to the higher plane.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like alien etiquette, kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I wrote down some of what I heard, and they included things like, can you follow instructions without adding interpretation? Can you deliver instructions as you receive them? So I'm hearing, can you follow orders and do as we say and be controlled by us? They forbade things like clumsiness, procrastination.
Uh-oh, and even, I'm not allowed in.
And even having private thoughts. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that is wild. You're not allowed to have private thoughts. And then also arousal was forbidden.
Oh, yeah. Right.
How did you feel about these steps? I mean, what did you feel good about them?
Yeah, because we were already, to a degree, brainwashed in a sense. We were motivated. You know, it's like this carrot out in front of us that if you do as we teach you, you will graduate. You will ascend to this next evolutionary level. Right. And during that first year, the first several years, the idea was that we would ascend while conscious and alive.
Right.
We would ascend consciously into this next evolutionary level above human.
So tell us what vehicles means.
Vehicle is your body that you as a soul inhabit, which I would say is accurate to a degree. But it was also considered the same as a car would be to a driver. Hmm. So the soul is the driver of the car, of the vehicle. Hmm. T would often say, get your mind into your vehicle, meaning get your vehicle under control of your mind. Mm. Kind of like a rider on a horse. A rider doesn't let the horse run wild. Mm-hmm. The rider keeps the horse doing what the rider wants the horse to do.
Mm. So getting your sexual urges under control is a big piece of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I'm a little familiar with that idea, just having grown up Mormon. Mm-hmm. Where sexuality is, you know, there's a lot of shame around it. And I felt a lot, you know, anytime I would feel an urge or like masturbate or anything, I just felt so ashamed after. Did you, you know, how successful were you in suppressing those urges, or did you like feel shame? Like, what was going on there?
Well, when we were on the road, we're virtually always in the presence of our check partner. Mm. And the goal in the assignment of check partners was if you could easily be attracted to a member of the opposite sex or a member of the same sex, if that was your sexual orientation, then they would partner you with someone who you would not be attracted to. At least, you know, that was the goal. Mm. It didn't always work out that way. I mean, that's why some of the people left, is because they found someone they were attracted to and they left with them. Mm. That's why I generally was partnered with a male.
Listening back to that, I'm like, banning private thoughts, literally, what does that mean? Mm. What other kind of thoughts are there?
Well, I mean, they're just priming people to think of themselves as a vehicle, because how else are you going to have people kill themselves, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I mean, you can't not have private thoughts, but I guess you can convince people that there's some sort of shared thoughts that they should be subscribing to.
It's really even just like this idea of like fighting what your body is doing. Like, it's really just completely disconnecting yourself from yourself in every way. And like, I don't know if y'all have heard this, but your brain just randomly generates thoughts. You literally can't control them. It's like the first thing we learn in OCD, you know, work. It just does that. So if you are going to start feeling shame just because you had a thought pop into your head every time, and I mean, it's just setting you up to fail and to constantly feel like you need to do better. You need to do better. You need to do better.
Yeah.
You're not going to stop yourself from getting morning wood. Like, that's not your fault. Like, and that should be fine anyway.
And I don't even know if this really applies. We can cut this out. But one thing that was really helpful for me was just being like, okay, I can see in like brain scans that a healthier brain is one that's not trying to control their thoughts as much. So I believe that whoever created us, God, universe, whatever, quotation marks, wants us to be the healthiest version of ourselves that we can be. Mm-hmm. Why would it put 4 trillion nerves in the clitoris if it's not supposed to be touched? That's insane. Like, is your God that weird?
Well, why also would it give men, like, slightly raise men's risk of cancer if they never ejaculate?
Oh, that's so bad for you. You know, so with that sort of guilt, just like those scientific facts always help me come back to a balance. I don't know if we want to leave that in. It might be too much, but.
Well, no, anyway. I mean, I think like, in general, too, like there's this long history of extreme groups or cultish groups or high control groups telling you, don't listen to your body, don't listen to your body, don't listen to your body. And what you learn then is like, don't listen to your instincts that tell you that something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Don't listen to your own intuition. Don't listen to all the red flags that come up, because it's like disconnecting yourself from your critical thinking.
Exactly.
It's turning that off. Yeah. And adding an additional layer of extreme shame because what they're asking for is literally impossible.
Absolutely impossible.
Yeah.
And if you feel like you're succeeding, you're probably on the inside going slowly insane.
Yep. So what we're saying is everybody masturbate.
Yeah, yeah, please. My God. Go for it.
Go for it. You won't get hair in your palms, I promise.
Hair in your palms?
You don't know about that? Used to tell boys that if they masturbated, they would grow hair in their palms.
But nobody did. So then what?
Come on. You think people are basing this off of rational evidence?
Wow. Okay.
That was an old wives' tale.
I guess I identify as an addict. So that does get confusing when your instincts are like, well, you should have 20 beers. That'll help. You know?
Totally.
So there is that other side of it too.
No, I mean, and that's true for me too. I mean, like if I listen to all of the anxious thoughts that come into my head, I would like lose my mind.
Therapy? Is that what we're...
What we're saying is like moderation and like listening to yourself to the like because my true self knows that those crazy thoughts are not the thoughts I should be listening to. You know what I mean?
Of course. It's just, you know, it's so few and far between. Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason that you sought out 12-step programs and healing and stuff because you know that that's not what your like true self wants, right?
Exactly. Exactly. But it's also easy for me to like right now I'm drinking. So it's easy for me to be like, whatever, it's fine. And then it's not fine. So, you know.
Listen, life is complicated.
It is. It really, really is. I want to do a stand-up joke where it's talking about how, like, having mental illness is like being in the movie The Notebook, but with yourself. And every once in a while, you'll come online and, like, know the truth, like, at the end, you know? And you'll be like, oh, my gosh, this is my true self. This is what we should do. And then your other self is like, how much time do we have? And you're like, 5 minutes until I go back into not knowing anymore. Anyway.
I have a new song coming out, not to plug my own forthcoming music.
Plug it.
Coincidentally, the song is also called Trust Me. But one of the lines is about that very thing. It says, the body is wise, but mine is broken.
Mm.
But generally speaking, what cults are trying to do is turn off your critical thinking.
And your body's innate awareness of what it needs.
Yes.
Agreed.
Exactly. Moving right along here. So this next clip that we're going to play is from someone whose story is just incredibly compelling. And what we wanted to hear from him about was his moment of sort of realizing that the group that he was in, which was a white supremacist group, was maybe not for him. So let's hear him talk about that.
A buddy of mine said he can get me a job carrying in and out antique furniture at an antique show in Cherry Hill, New Jersey for the weekend, $100 a day. And I said to my friend, who was also a neo-Nazi at the time, I said, yeah, I'll take the job. And he goes, but I got to tell you, dude, the guy that owns the company is a Jew. Like he's like Jewish. I just said to him, I said, well, you told him, he goes, I told him all about you. I said, you don't care what I believe. And he said, Frank, Keith said this. And his name is Keith Brookstein. He goes, Keith said this. He don't give a rat's ass what you believe. Just don't break his fucking furniture. And I showed up and I worked for this guy. And at the end of my 3 days, he owed me $300. I'd already gotten paid like $600 in tips because people tip you as you carry furniture to their cars. And I made like $600 in tips. So when this guy came up to give me my $300, I thought he was going to, you know, my anti-Semitic ignorant way, he was going to Jew me. And he came up and he said, hey, how much do I owe you? It was the end of this Sunday. I said, $300, dude, like waiting to see if he's going to argue with me, you know? And he just pulled out this money and was like, one, two, three, here's 300. He was like, you know what? Here's an extra $100. You're a really good worker. So I made $1,000 in that weekend. And you know, and there's something that we all do as human beings because we ain't too all far from each other. I might've been a neo-Nazi, but we all have resentments. We all have those grudges and, you know, just on yourself. So you think about it. There's times where you were going to go to work and yesterday Nancy said something that really pissed you off and Nancy's been in your head. You can't wait tomorrow. You know what? She says that same stuff. You're going to argue with her. You're going to come back at her. You plot the whole argument. You practice in the mirror. You wake up in the middle of the night thinking about Nancy. Mm-hmm. You go to work. Can't wait to see Nancy today. She's probably going to wear her stupid Dallas Cowboys stuff again. All right. You think about Nancy. You go, and then you get to work and you see Nancy and you're like, what's up, Nancy? And Nancy's like, no, what's going on? And you're like, nothing. It's all good. Because we love that part of having the resentment of telling Nancy off in our head. Well, I did that with this Jewish dude. I can't wait to tell this dude off. Mm. He's going to try and rip me off. He's going to try and Jew me. And here it was nothing of the sorts. So then he gave me a ride home and he says, yo, what do you do for a living? I pointed to the swastika on my neck and I said, I don't do anything, man. He goes, well, why don't you come work for me? And I went and I worked for this man. And my other neo-Nazi friend worked for him too.
Wow.
And Keith, like he didn't take too much time with my other friend, but with me, whenever he had to go pick up furniture, he always be like, Frank, get in the trunk with me. Let's go get this furniture. And it'd be like in North Jersey somewhere. We'd be like 2 hours on the road. He'd be like, hey, Frank, I got to go pick up this dining room set so we could, you know, get it back to the warehouse, get it refinished, get it in the storefronts. I mean, the dude had a business, a big business of redoing antiques. And I'd jump in a truck and we get the Philly paper and I read the what's going on in the O.J. Simpson trial at the time. And I read it to him and we'd talk and talk about life and trial and race. And we just had great conversations all the time. And I started to enjoy these rides. And this guy was not religiously Jewish, but Keith, he would always go, ugh. I mean, Upper East Coast Jewish hardcore, you know, and we would just always talk. And I did this one thing and which led to me knowing it's one of the things that I know that makes me an alcoholic is I always think less of myself, you know, and I know a lot of people do that, but I think about myself too much and I think too less of myself, you know. And so whenever I would make a mistake, I'd always go, oh, Keith, I'm so stupid, you know. And I didn't say like I'm stupid, you know, like a skinny girl will say, oh, my God, I'm fat. So everyone goes, oh, my God, Michelle, you're not fat. Like, I didn't say I'm stupid because I wanted people to say you're not stupid. I just said it all the time. Like, if I messed up, oh, I'm so stupid. And so one day I broke something and Keith, I was like, oh, Keith, I'm so stupid. And he came over and he just gripped me up and he goes, stop saying you're stupid, you fucking idiot. Let's go. And I cleaned up this mess I made and we got in the truck and I went from the fire me because it was a marble top table I broke. It was expensive. And he just unloaded on me. He started telling me about times when he's like, remember when you said this? Remember when you figured this out? Like, that's smart, Frank. That's, you can't pay for that education you got. And I just remember listening to him and just being like so grateful to have this human being in my life with a swastika blazing at him every day in the truck. Mm. That day, Keith goes to drop me off. I still have a shaved head. I still wear my neo-Nazi boots every day to this guy's work. And that was the day when he was talking to me and talking to me about how smart I was and just showing me genuine love and concern and also calling me a fucking idiot. When he did that, like, I was so embarrassed of those boots on my feet that day. Like, I just felt it.
Oh,
yeah.
God, it's such an amazing story. So this is Frank Mink. The previous guest that we listened to was Frank Lifford. So we have two Franks in a row. Frank Lifford is Heaven's Gate. Frank Mink was the former neo-Nazi. And it just brings me back to the same thing we talk about all the time, which is that, like, the way to get someone out of extreme belief is just through basic human connection.
Yep.
Non-judgmental care and connection.
Totally. And not everybody's going to have the same strength to meet somebody who's completely
who hates them
and that's not their job, you know.
It's not their job. Yeah, so, but like, if it's your family member or someone you love, like, I feel like every time, I mean, actually Frank Lifford from Heaven's Gate, his way out started with having also a boss who showed him care and showed him a different kind of life than the one that he'd been experiencing.
And listened.
And listened, yes. And it's just like, just a real connection, just a genuine, authentic connection without having to be like, well, fuck you for believing that, or I can't believe you think that, that's crazy, or whatever.
Oh, interesting. Why do you believe that? Oh, you know, just listening and hearing someone. I think that's what Chitarth also said, that somebody, the people in Reddit groups were just listening to him and being kind to him and letting him spew stuff he believed and not immediately arguing with him.
That's, yeah, definitely, definitely. And I've seen that with loved ones of my own who've done really great work in this space. The way that you really actually help people is to just show them some care.
Yeah.
And for sure, like, that's not everyone's responsibility to take on.
No, if somebody's just a racist bigot running their mouth all the time, you're not
that's
required.
That's not your job.
No.
But it does give me hope, though, because so much of the time, like, we see someone we care about falling into a rabbit hole like this and we're like, there's nothing I can do. And the truth is, like, there might be nothing you can do on the timeline that you want, But there is something you can do, and that's just be there for that person.
Yeah, it's difficult. It is difficult.
It is difficult.
Yeah.
And I think it's especially difficult when they're still very much embedded in the community. But if you remain a presence in their life, the thing we hear over and over again is that when they're ready and when that group is no longer serving them and they know that they have someone else and they have an alternative lifestyle available to them, then they'll come.
Yeah.
All right, you guys. Well, we're nearing the end of the cult journey here. We have one more guest that we're going to hear from. And we wanted to touch on what it's like if you've actually experienced some of this kind of trauma. And are we beholden to this trauma forever, you know? And the answer is probably not. We will hear from Richard Tedeschi, who is a professor of psychology who helped originate the concept of post-traumatic growth. For me and for some of my friends who've had traumatic experiences too, the hardest part is like, what is happening? What is happening? Why is this happening? And it feels chaotic and it feels like you have no control over the world and the universe and yourself. And so just like breaking it apart has been something that's been life-changing for me. I'm like, okay, this is what I'm experiencing. This is why it's happening. Organizing it is, yeah, that just makes a lot of sense to me because that was what was helpful for me.
Getting so mad at yourself too, you know, if you're not feeling whatever, but then if you reframe it as, oh, I'm working out almost, like I'm getting stronger, then that's a whole different period of time.
But you have to like being able to name what's happening to you and like have a way of understanding what happened. To me, that was like the most important thing. And I think for my mom, that was the most important thing too. Because especially people who've been in cults, they're like, I don't understand what's just happened to me. You know, it feels chaotic.
Yeah, making sense of things is really important. I work for an organization called Boulder Crest Foundation in Bluemont, Virginia. And we serve their military veterans and first responders like firefighters, police, EMTs. People have been through trauma mostly because of their work and have trauma histories. So our program is based on the post-traumatic growth concept. One of the things in our program that we emphasize is that we give them the message, it's not what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you. Because so many of these men and women come to us with diagnoses of PTSD or something. They've gotten lots of messages that they're broken and they're damaged and they start to feel useless. And we emphasize that, you know, it's about the events that you've gone through in your life and what it's done to your way of understanding yourself, understanding the world around you that you live in, and robbing you of a future that feels like it's going to be purposeful and meaningful. Mm-hmm. We especially find this with veterans coming out of their service, don't know any longer what they're supposed to do with themselves, and have perhaps seen and experienced some terrible things. We have to help them see that there is a further purpose to life and a way that they can serve and be useful so their lives continue in a direction where there's an ongoing story of possibility for them. Another thing that we emphasize with post-traumatic growth, it's important for people to have a mission. It's important for people to have something to do that benefits other people, not just makes them feel better or takes care of some symptoms they have like nightmares or something. Mm. It goes beyond that. You've got to have a reason for living that benefits people out there in the world, whether it's your family or your neighborhood or your city or your organization or your country or somebody mm-hmm. beyond you. That's what's important, because otherwise the suffering you've gone through may feel like it's just in vain.
What is catastrophe theory?
Yeah, well, okay. Catastrophe theory is a theory which posits that there are certain breaking points that you cannot reconstruct what's been broken and have it be in the same form. You know, if you have a piece of material and you start to put pressures on it, eventually it'll break, and different materials break, different plastic, steel, whatever, they break it in different times and with different amount of pressure. And once it's broken, you can't just put it back together and it'd be exactly right. The same as it was. Right. So right. Same thing with post-traumatic growth. I mean, we break in a way because of these events and we put ourselves back together, but we're different. We can't go back to the way we used to be, which is a good thing. In the new version of us, we're maybe better and more than we were in the old version. So for example, on the cover of the book that I mentioned, Transformed by Trauma, Stories of Post-Traumatic Growth, we have a picture of a piece of pottery that's been broken and put back together with gold.
Right. It's that one method that I always forget the name of.
It's a Japanese art called kintsugi.
Right, right.
And deliberately break these pieces of pottery and put them back together with precious metals, and showing that it's even more beautiful than it was when it was whole.
Yeah. So this is from our Rethinking Trauma series that we did back in March of this year, which I still am so proud of those episodes.
Me too. They were so informative.
It's just such an important thing to give ourselves a path forward and not like conceive of the fact that we have been harmed in some way or we've experienced pain in some way as something that's going to like ruin our lives.
Yeah.
Or like just we'll never heal from it or get better. Like to me, that's just disempowering and not true. And so it was so refreshing and so fascinating to hear from all these different people about like here are different ways that you can grow.
Yeah. I mean, Elisheba, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our last guest went through hell.
She went through hell.
And she is really thriving.
It's true. It's like when you're first out of, you know, an abusive experience or a high control group or whatever, I think it can feel so vague and confusing and there's so much shame.
Insurmountable.
Like you just don't really know where to place yourself in the world anymore.
Yeah, there's no context for it. You're like lost in the mud.
You're like, what? That was my whole life. If that's not real, then like what? Where is my meaning going to come from?
And I think people who haven't experienced that in the cult form could see it in like a bad relationship form.
Totally.
When you get out of one and you're just like, whoa, I'm lost. What is everything? And then a couple years or however long it takes, you're like, I cannot believe I almost just ruined my whole life for this relationship. And I can now see it clearly and everything's in perspective again. But for those first couple, however long it takes, you're really, there's no like focal point, which is why therapy is so important.
Totally. And it comes back to something that Richard Tedeschi was talking about a lot, which is that like our personal, and something my mom talks about a lot, which is that our personal narrative, like the story we tell ourselves and others of our lives, is so crucial to healing from difficult things that we've experienced.
Right.
I like things to be very like logical and like scientific. So that part of my brain really hates that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I talked about that a little bit too, because storytelling is so subjective. And if you can just like weave an experience you had into your story, I mean, that could just be any story. So like, what does anything even mean if it's just completely subjective and you're making it up? But the truth is, well, you're not making it up for one. And for another, you can create a story for yourself that is true, that accurately reflects what has happened to you, but does it in a way that helps you to grow and change and heal and get better, as opposed to, I'm fucked.
Yeah, there's two sides to every story, even in your own brain.
It's true. It's, believe me, that dialogue is just constantly, that battle is constant in my head.
Oh, same.
But no, it gives me a lot of hope, and hearing so many of our guest stories gives me a lot of hope, because these are such incredible people. Everyone we've had on has just been so strong and incredible and articulate and interesting and have overcome so much.
Lots of knowledge to be gleaned from these people.
Absolutely. I am proud of our 100 episodes of Trust Me.
Me too. Steve is clapping.
Steve is clapping. Yay.
Steve, thank you. Gabby, thank you. Everyone.
Yeah, thanks y'all so much for listening to us. Even if it's your first time, thanks for listening one time. But if it's your 100th time, wow, thank you for listening 100 times.
Woo! Leave us a comment on Apple or wherever you leave comments. Okay. And rate us 5 stars. Why not?
Yeah, 5 stars.
Come on.
5 stars. No, y'all, thank you so much. And we will be back with a regular episode next week.
Thanks, guys. We'll see you next week. And as always, remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags,
and never, ever trust me.
Boop.
Later. Trust Me is produced by Kirsten Woodward, Gabby Rapp, and Steve Delamater.
With special thanks to Stacey Para.
And our theme song was composed by Holly Amber Church.
You can find us on Instagram at Trust Me Podcast, Twitter at Trust Me Cult Pod, or on TikTok at Trust Me Cult Podcast.
I'm Ula Lola on Instagram and Ola Lola on Twitter.
And I am Megan Elizabeth 11 on Instagram and Babraham Hicks on Twitter.
Remember to rate and review and spread the word.